globe, world orders, and catastrophic change. Happy belated birthday to Kieran Crabb-Meadows and Ishmael Darrow. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
The heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hey, this is Wes Geer, formerly of Head PE, formerly of Korn, now with Human, and the founder of Rock to Recovery. I'm asking you to tune in to KBOO on Monday, November 22nd at 11 p.m. for Eclectic Pandemic on your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office hires four new prosecutors to focus on gun violence. Pfizer asks the FDA to authorize its experimental COVID-19 antiviral treatment. And the families of those killed in the Sandy Hook school shooting win their defamation case against conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 16th, 2021. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Drug maker Pfizer asked the U.S. Food and Drug Administration on Tuesday to authorize its experimental COVID-19 antiviral treatment called Paxlovid. Pfizer's treatment consists of three pills taken twice daily for 5 days. It's meant to be given early within 3 to 5 days of symptoms. Experts say an antiviral pill for COVID would have a major impact on the pandemic by making treatment available at home without an injection or IV. Earlier this month, Pfizer said its pill cut the risk of hospitalization and death by nearly 90% in people with mild to moderate coronavirus infections. Pfizer also announced Tuesday that it has signed a deal with a United Nations-backed group to allow other manufacturers to make its COVID-19 pill. The move would make it so that the pill can be sold inexpensively in 95 poorer nations that are home to more than half of the world's population. In a statement issued Tuesday, Pfizer said it would grant a license for the antiviral pill to the Geneva-based Medicines Patent Pool, allowing generic drug companies to produce the pill. The deal does exclude some large countries that have suffered devastating coronavirus outbreaks. For example, while a Brazilian drug company could get a license to make the pill for export to other countries, the medicine could not be made generically for use in Brazil. Doctors Without Borders said it was disheartened that the Pfizer deal does not make the drug available to the entire world, noting that the agreement announced Tuesday also excludes countries including China, Argentina, and Thailand. Still, health officials said the fact that the deal was struck even before Pfizer's pill has been authorized could help to end the pandemic quicker. It's estimated that other drug makers could be able to start producing the pill within months. Under the terms of the agreement, Pfizer will not receive royalties on sales in low-income countries and will waive royalties on sales in all countries covered by the agreement while COVID-19 remains a public health emergency. The Biden administration is also expected to announce this week that it is purchasing 10 million courses of Pfizer's COVID pill. Officials hope the multi-billion dollar investment will help change the trajectory of the pandemic by preventing many hospitalizations and deaths. The Oregon Health Authority reported 1,935 new COVID-19 cases on Monday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 308,091. Oregon health officials also reported 53 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 4,803 people. Last week, hospitalizations fell below 500 for the first time in Oregon since early August. On Monday, OHA reported that 461 people are currently hospitalized statewide, including 109 patients in intensive care units. There is currently 11% availability of adult ICU beds across the state, with 9% of non-ICU beds available. Nationally, the U.S. has reported more than 47.1 million coronavirus cases. At least 763,178 people have died. The national case average has been relatively flat in recent weeks, but deteriorating conditions in parts of the West, Upper Midwest, and Northeast have started to push those figures slightly upward. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 253 million people. More than half the world's population has received at least one vaccine dose, although the global figure masks vast disparities in vaccine access between wealthy and poor nations. About 75% of shots that have gone into arms worldwide have been administered in high and upper middle income countries. Less than 1% of doses have been administered in low income countries. At least 5.1 million people have died across the world. The U.S. Department of Justice sent a letter to the City of Portland attorney and Portland Police Chief Chuck Lavelle on Monday with recommendations for police body camera use. In April, the City of Portland was put on notice that it was not in compliance with its 2014 settlement to enact certain police accountability reforms, including body cameras. Among the DOJ recommendations includes a reform that body cameras should automatically activate when, quote, a member draws a firearm. The DOJ also suggests that body-worn camera recordings may be disclosed without a public records request, and that, quote, recordings in their original form will be maintained by a third-party vendor that the city contracts with to provide services. However, the city will retain ownership. This DOJ letter comes as city leaders are meeting Wednesday for Portland's fall budget monitoring process, where potential funding for police reforms may be decided amid the city's budget surplus. Mayor Ted Wheeler's budget proposal includes more than $2.8 million towards body cameras for the Portland Police Bureau. Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty has said, with some caveats, she could be in favor of the body camera reform. Hardesty said, quote, my thinking has evolved since 2012 when we first started about body cameras. Now, knowing that we can hire a third-party vendor that would own the footage, knowing that police will not have access to body camera footage prior to writing their written report, I am much more comfortable. Not to mention, the DOJ is strongly encouraging us to buy body cams, end quote. Along with Mayor Wheeler, Commissioner Mingus Mapps and Portland Police Bureau Chief Lavelle have also said they support the use of body cameras by police in the city. Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt announced Monday that he has hired four new prosecutors to support investigations involving firearms. The move comes as Portland's homicide rate is at an all-time high, The DA's office says the volume of cases this year is beyond their capacity. This addition of county prosecutors follows a $1 million investment from the county in an effort to fight gun violence. The new prosecutors will start full-time in December and help with the county's caseload, which has been impacted by the pandemic. The DA's office has called the increasing violence in the area a public health crisis and has partnered with community organizations that focus on behavioral health and conflict resolution. The new positions at the DA's office reflect the county's push to curb gun violence, as the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office has hired two deputies who will specialize in family protection orders, court-ordered dispossession of firearms, and emergency investments in housing. Multnomah County Prosecutor Kate Molina said, quote, "New prosecutors means more time can be devoted to individual cases and means more people who can be called upon to help when a life is lost." The jury in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial was handed the case late Monday after highly publicized testimony that centered around the fairness of self-defense laws. Ground-level activists say the case shows that laws and how they're applied still fail to protect marginalized residents. Mike Moen has more on the story with the Public News Service.
As the Kyle Rittenhouse trial enters its final phase this week, a Wisconsin group focused on improving the lives of black residents says the case speaks to issues of democracy not working for everybody. The 18-year-old Rittenhouse is charged with killing two protesters in Kenosha last year and wounding another with a semi-automatic rifle. Prosecutors say the Illinois resident was a vigilante in a situation where he didn't belong. But the teen's lawyers say he acted in self-defense after crossing state lines to protect property amid protests over police brutality. Kyle Johnson of Black Leaders Organizing Communities feels the legal system paved the way for someone to take the law into their own hands.
The legal system in this country operates with a tint, more than a tint, with a shade, with a shadow of racism.
Legal experts have said the case hinged on self-defense laws. Reform advocates say Wisconsin's statute for these situations is too murky and needs an overhaul. Racial justice groups add that Rittenhouse is being portrayed as a martyr by those who strongly back police. But his backers say he had no other choice but to shoot amid the surrounding chaos, while also noting that all those Rittenhouse shot were white. Researchers have noted criminal justice issues help to further alienate BIPOC voters, making them reluctant to demand fairness through civic engagement. The Kenosha incidents happened after the police shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man left paralyzed by his injuries. Block's executive director, Angela Lang, says not taking steps to implement meaningful police reforms or change self-defense laws will only create more of these situations.
This continues to happen because there is a space that we are giving that is allowing for this to happen.
She feels white supremacy has too much influence within the legal system, arguing people like Rittenhouse are given ample opportunity to act recklessly, while people like Breonna Taylor don't even have a chance to defend themselves. Taylor was the black medical worker shot and killed by Louisville police officers in March of 2020 during a botched raid on her apartment. I'm Mike Mullen reporting.
InfoWars host and conspiracy theorist Alex Jones was found liable Monday for damages in lawsuits brought by parents of children killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting over Jones's claim that the massacre was a hoax. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Sandy Hook families suing InfoWars founder Alex Jones won another case against him. A judge ruled against Jones by default when he did not comply with discovery demands. Jones previously claimed the 2012 Sandy Hook mass shooting was staged, though he later acknowledged it was real. The shooting killed 20 first graders and 6 educators. Jones theorized this was a U.S. government-led plan to confiscate firearms and that the victims' families were actors in the plot. Believers in his theory harassed families online, publicly, and at their homes, even threatening their lives. Families of the victims sued Jones, both in Texas and Connecticut courts. Texas ruled against Jones in 2 previous defamation lawsuits. Connecticut Superior Court Judge Barbara Bellis said willful noncompliance with the discovery process formed the basis for the recent ruling. Specifically, Jones and entities he owned did not turn over financial and analytics data requested multiple times by the plaintiffs. Chris Maddy, representing the families, said Jones and his companies deliberately concealed his evidence of the relationship between what they published and how they make money. He said, quote, Mr. Jones was given every opportunity to comply, end quote. He added the court's ruling was a legal victory, but that the battle to shed light on how deeply Jones has harmed the families continues. The Connecticut case will now proceed to a hearing with a discussion of damages. Jones has now lost all of the defamation lawsuits filed against him by families of 10 Sandy Hook victims. He responded to the ruling saying, quote, we need to defend all of our speech rights to say whatever it is we wish. That's the First Amendment, end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
This week is American Education Week, which includes a celebration on Wednesday of education support staff such as bus drivers, maintenance, and nutrition service workers. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
This week is American Education Week, and on Wednesday, the celebration is for education support professionals. Also known as ESPs, their work in schools include clerical support, maintenance, security, and paraeducators. They work in the K-12 system as well as higher education. Janie White is vice president of the Washington Education Association and a former ESP. She says ESPs have been critical during the pandemic, even when schools shut down.
Our ESPs are the first responders, so they never left the building. They have been there to make sure that our students have hot meals, our families have hot meals, and transportation worked with nutrition services to deliver the food.
White says transportation workers also delivered the technology students needed to work remotely, and custodians have ensured the building stayed clean throughout the pandemic. She encourages folks to show their appreciation for ESPs on Wednesday. She also wants to ensure that ESPs are supported by districts, noting that they often are the first staff members to be cut when schools tighten their belts.
We have to make sure that the funding that the state brings forward to our schools and our districts, that we have compensation for our ESPs, because the majority of our ESPs are the lowest paid employees in the district.
White says teachers and ASPs are a team working for students.
We work together to make our kids get full tools they need to be equipped for the work that they do. Fully equipped human beings, that's our goal.
Other celebrations for American Education Week include Family Day on Tuesday and Substitute Educators Day on Friday. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 51 degrees. Today in history, in 2001, the first Harry Potter film premieres in movie theaters across the U.S., based on the mega best-selling fantasy novel of the same name by J.K. Rowling. The film went on to become one of the highest-grossing movies in history. The quote of the day is from American politician, educator, and author Shirley Chisholm, who was the first black woman elected to the U.S. Congress. Chisholm said, quote, if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. Former Trump advisor Steve Bannon surrenders to police. Beto O'Rourke is running for Texas governor, and President Joe Biden signs an executive order to address violence against Native Americans. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We got the Hispanics coming on our side, African Americans coming on our side. We're taking down the Biden regime. Former Trump White House strategist Steve Bannon spoke as he surrendered to law enforcement Monday, appearing for a hearing after being indicted by a grand jury for defying a congressional subpoena. Bannon faces two charges of contempt of Congress for failing to appear for deposition before the January 6 committee and for refusing to provide documents to the panel. Former Democratic Texas State Representative Beto O'Rourke announced he will run for governor of the Lone Star State. In a fundraising email to supporters, he touted himself as a unity candidate. Here's O'Rourke criticizing Republican lawmakers.
They're focusing on the kind of extremist policies around abortion or permitless carry or even in our schools that really only divide us.
Democratic Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, the longest-serving active member of the U.S. Senate, announced he'll retire after 8 terms. His last expected day is January 2, 2023. At a press conference, Leahy reflected on his career, which began when he was elected to the Senate in 1974.
And within just a few months of taking office, as the newest and by far most junior member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, we were asked to vote to reauthorize and continue the war in Vietnam.
President Biden signed an executive order addressing violence against indigenous communities, particularly women. It directs the Departments of Justice, Interior, Homeland Security, and Health and Human Services to create a strategy to improve public safety and justice for Native Americans. President of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohican Indians, Shannon Hosley, spoke Monday during a White House virtual summit with tribal leaders.
Tribal sovereignty and self-governance, as well as honoring the federal trust responsibility to tribal nations, should be the cornerstone of federal Indian policy.
Biden also signed the infrastructure bill and tapped former New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu to coordinate implementation of the $1.2 trillion bipartisan legislation. Meanwhile, at the White House late Monday, President Biden met virtually with Chinese President Xi Jinping. The two leaders discussed trade, military aggression, and human rights. Finally, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, lawyers delivered closing arguments Monday in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, the teenage gunman who fatally shot 2 people and wounded a third during protests last year over police brutality. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
President Joe Biden announces 5 new initiatives for Indian Country and tribes use indigenous knowledge to address climate change. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Biden signed an executive order Monday to improve public safety and criminal justice for Native Americans and to address missing and murdered indigenous people. The order seeks to build upon policies and work on coordination of federal law enforcement strategies to prevent and respond to violence. Biden signed the order at the White House Tribal Nations Summit in attendance with the First Lady, cabinet secretaries, and tribal leaders watching virtually.
Today, I'm directing federal officials to work with tribal nations on strategies to improve public safety and advance justice. This builds on the work we did together in reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act in 2013, when we granted authority to tribes to exercise jurisdiction over non-Indian offenders who commit violence on tribal lands. We're going to reauthorize that again. We're going to expand the jurisdiction to include other offenses like sex trafficking, sexual assault, and child abuse.
The signing of the executive order was among 5 new initiatives Biden announced for Indian Country. The other initiatives involve protecting tribal treaty rights in the work of the federal government, increase tribal participation in the management of federal lands, incorporate tribal knowledge into the government's approach to fight climate change, and taking action to protect the Greater Chaco Canyon landscape in New Mexico from new oil and gas development. Also on Monday, President Biden signed the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which includes more than $11 billion in investments for tribal communities. Tribal leaders took part in a policy panel on education and language during Monday's White House Tribal Nations Summit. Principal Chief of the Cherokee Nation, Chuck Hoskin Jr., talked about his tribe's investments in upgrading Head Start centers and expanding the Cherokee Language Immersion School. But he says one of the ways the administration can help is by creating a joint venture program at the Bureau of Indian Education to allow tribes to incur construction costs for upgrading BIE facilities.
We'll take resources committed by the federal government, but it'll also take trust in the tribes to know how to chart a destiny when it comes to education, including investing in capital improvements at our own schools. We can do it. We can do it better than anyone. But we need the federal government to give us some additional flexibility. So that's one point on which I would challenge the administration to take a look at, see how we can be more flexible with our Bureau of Indian Education schools, particularly those that are operated by tribes, as is the case of the Cherokee Nation.
Hoskin also highlighted the tribe's effort to save the Cherokee language. The summit continues Tuesday. Tribal officials are sounding the alarm about climate change's disproportionate impacts on their communities. The Mountain West News Bureau's Robin Vincent reports.
Tribal leaders say the region's historic drought is wreaking havoc on the land and altering a way of life long centered on hunting and fishing. Jordan Dresser is chairman of the Northern Arapaho Tribe. He says short springs in Wyoming have led to longer wildfire seasons. But he sees some bright spots when it comes to tackling climate change.
It's pushing us to really tap into our indigenous power and our indigenous knowledge.
Dresser cited the tribe's buffalo herd. He says they recently birthed their first calf, and ensuring the herd's vitality is one way for the Northern Arapaho to become sustainable and reconnect to Native culture. Now tribal communities are anticipating billions in funding from the federal infrastructure bill. It includes money for climate adaptation and resilience, wildfire mitigation, and clean energy. I'm Robin Vincent.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The shipping industry is considering an old solution to a modern problem. Shipping vessels could cut carbon pollution by harnessing the wind. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For hundreds of years, global trade was made possible by the wind, and masted ships sailed the seas. Today, the shipping industry is looking to harness the wind once again. Gavin Allwright is with the International Windship Association, a nonprofit trade group.
When we first started back in 2014, I was the strange guy in the room. You know, talking about wind, the perception was, why should we even consider this?
But that attitude is changing as the industry tries to reduce carbon emissions and improve the efficiency of conventional cargo ships and tankers. Modern wind technologies include tall cylindrical rotors and rigid sails that resemble upright airplane wings. They don't look like the sails of the past, but they apply the same concept, using wind to create thrust, which helps propel the ship. A handful of large shipping companies have already retrofitted a few vessels with wind technology. Allwright says the changes can reduce fuel use by 5% to 20%. For a big ship, that adds up to significant cost savings over time.
Wind energy is delivered for free for the rest of the lifetime of that vessel.
And it could help propel global shipping to a cleaner future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 16th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, the producer is Yasmin Kovanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Nadia Romlagon, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kovanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, it's Fight the Empire, connecting history with the latest world events with host Per Fagerang. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Food Show, keeping you on top of the news and issues surrounding the food on your plate with host Emily Becker. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
Making contact.
In some parts of the world, traditional herbal remedies are the norm. When we think of natural remedies, we tend to think of older generations living in remote areas in faraway countries with little access to modern healthcare. Rarely do we think about the ancient medicinal plants that might exist in our very own cities. Making Contact's Anita Johnson has more.
Nestled in the Skyline Hills of Oakland, California, residents have a volcano in their backyard at Sibley Volcanic Regional Preserve.
It's an old volcano, really, really old, 10 million years old, they say. And the entire park is structured around the energy of this volcano as it exists today. There's certain trails which are just old lava rock trails. And over the 10 million years, lots of medicine plants have evolved here. And that's what we're on the hunt for today. I haven't been here in a while, so we're just going to go like I go, looking to see what we can find. So let's go this way.
Michelle Elizabeth Lee, a practitioner of traditional plant medicine, and a native of Oakland, California, was raised in a family of traditional healers from Mississippi and Louisiana.